Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Library of the Sapphire Wind by Jane Linscold. Narrated by Elizabeth Ashby. Chapter 1. I wonder why I'm wondering if I'm late, thought Tessa Brown as she hurried through the front door of Pagerian Books. After all, it's Valentine's Day. I'm probably the only one who's going to show up for book club. Unbuttoning her coat, she waved to the college student at the cashier's station, one of her students in the Introduction to Archaeology course she taught at Taiyima University almost every autumn term.
"Nice to see you, Dr. Brown," the young man called as he put his customer's order into a shiny bag printed with multicolored hearts. "Go on back. The meeting room is already open."
"Thanks." The meeting room was in the back of the store, a bookshelf-lined space with a large oval table in the center, surrounded by an array of the more comfortable sort of stackable chairs. Two of those chairs were occupied, with an empty one between. In the chair on the right sat Meg Blake, a retired librarian in her mid-70s. She'd moved to Taiyima, Pennsylvania shortly after the death of her husband, choosing the town because it was reinventing itself as an active retirement destination. Silver-haired, fair-skinned, with somewhat faded blue eyes, Meg radiated a timeless elegance that her friend envied just a little. Seated on the left of the empty chair was Peg Gallegos. Since Peg had never held a formal job, she couldn't be said to have retired. Thrice divorced, she remained so involved in the lives of her many children and grandchildren, even those who lived some distance away, that it was hard to imagine her ever retiring. Based on things Peg said about people she'd met, movies she'd seen, concerts she'd attended, and the like, Peg was probably somewhere in her 60s, but she adroitly refused to be pinned down. Peg had long ago given up the hair down past her butt of her hippie days, although, when loose, her hair still fell almost to the middle of her back. The silvering, dark brown locks had been artistically streaked, thus making, as Peg liked to say, a virtue of reality. She had her ethnically Hispanic mother's dark hair and lightly olive skin, accented with hazel eyes that blended brown and green. The lightening of the irises common with aging made them more green than brown, an effect Peg enhanced both with cosmetics and her choice of clothing.
"Sit here, Teg," called Peg. "I can already see Meg and I are going to disagree about the value of romance novels. You get to have the deciding vote."
In the book group, Tessa had become Teg when a new member had fumbled her name. Peg, who loved coining words, had been delighted, and the nickname had stuck. Tessa rather liked having a nickname, especially the sense of belonging it gave her. She'd always been just a bit of an outsider. Her heritage mixed European, African, and Asian, a Heinz 57 American, who didn't fit in with any culture, not even within her own family, where she had been an only child of parents who had split when she was in high school, so that her sense of having no place she belonged had been intensified. Although fairly short, years of archaeological fieldwork had given Teg broad shoulders and a solid build that made her anything but petite.
"I like what you've done with your hair, Teg," Meg added.
Lately, Teg's once jetty black hair had become a trial to her, showing enough gray to make her look older without being in the least interesting. Her most recent attempt to deal with graying had been a short, upswept punky cut that her thick hair held with a minimum of product. This she'd had dyed dark purple that gradually brightened to lavender near the tips.
"Thanks," Teg said, taking off her coat and putting it around the back of her chair. "Now, what's the argument?"
Usually the book club chose a specific book, or at least an author. However, in honor of Valentine's Day, it had been decided that a general discussion of romance novels was in order. Even as Teg listened to Meg's erudite outlining of how she considered romance novels not only formulaic, but potentially psychologically dangerous, given that they raised impossible expectations for relationships, Teg found herself thinking,
"Of course,
We three are the ones who showed up. The widow, the divorcee, and the commitment shy. Peg had pulled a box of fancy chocolates from her bag. After offering it around, she launched into her own argument. For me, I guess they're a guilty pleasure, a comfort read. But the more I think about it, why should I feel guilty? What's wrong with wanting to read a story that's going to come out all right in the end? Some of the more modern romance novels are very ambitious, and even classics like Barbara Cartland and Georgette Heyer often featured women who had to make their way in a world that wasn't very receptive to female independence. One of the things I dislike is the reliance on misunderstandings, Meg countered. When 5 minutes' discussion would clear up the identity of the young woman our heroine saw with her true love, why not talk? In historical romances, Peg shot back, social constraints often meant that sort of discussion was nearly impossible to have. Tag waved a hand. Ladies, please, how about we actually look at a sample text or two? Remember, I'm not much of a romance reader, and I lack Meg's general background. Great! Peg pulled out a battered paperback. This one is certain to hit all of Meg's buttons, but I loved it. Barbara Cartland, The Irresistible Buck. Wait, I'll find a good part. A moment later, Peg handed the book to Tag. Start with the second paragraph on the right-hand page. Tag nodded. Years of teaching meant that cold readings didn't hold any horror for her, but what came out of her mouth had nothing to do with Regency rogues or sweet but sassy debutantes. Curing one ill who is not sick. Finding the victim of a cruel trick. Easing an ache that cuts to the quick. All of this and more you will find after you pass through the doorways of the Library of the Sapphire Wind. Tag had hardly stopped speaking when the cluttered, book-lined room seemed to tilt sideways. Each woman grabbed hold of the arms of her chair. Peg shrieked, or Tag thought she shrieked. Peg's mouth had opened in a wide O, and Peg had been known to shriek. But the sound, if there was sound, was curiously muffled. Earthquake? Tag exclaimed, trying to shove back her chair from the table. We'd better get out of... She never finished the sentence. Between of and here, the room stopped tilting, and the three women were somewhere else. Where, they didn't know, but they knew with absolute certainty that this wasn't the familiar meeting room at Pagerian Books. The ambient glow of artificial light had been replaced by a brighter, somehow colder glow from off to one side. The walls were no longer of books but of stone, reddish-brown and seemingly unworked. The three women now sat not around a scuffed table, but within a circle of intricately carved pillars or columns, some of which were slightly tilted on their bases as if they had shifted over time. Perhaps because they had been holding on to them so hard, the chairs upon which the three women had sat had made the journey with them. So it was from a still-seated position that the three women met the astonished gazes of those who, so it would seem, were responsible for this change. These also numbered three, which seemed appropriate, but that's where anything stopped making even the remotest sort of sense. For one, although all three were bipedal and basically human in form, they either had very odd taste in headgear or were horribly deformed. Tag suddenly realized that neither was the case. Instead, each one of these people, although human in shape, had the head of an animal. Back at Pagerian Books, the three women had been seated in a crescent at one end of the large oval table, Tag in the middle, with Meg to her right, Peg to her left. They retained that configuration now. As if the table was still somehow present, which it wasn't, the other three people in the room were also arrayed in a crescent, although they were standing, not sitting. The one to the right had the head of a fox. The one to the left had the head of a deer. The one in the middle had the head of a young male lion. At least, Tag thought this last must be young because his mane was still straggly. Even though his features were completely feline, There was something about him that reminded her of a youth in his late teens or early 20s, desperately trying to grow his first beard. When Teg took a second look at the two others, her impression of youth was confirmed. The deer-headed one had antlers, true enough, but they only had a few tines, rather than being a great rack. The fox's head offered no easy clue, but the body was slender, the breasts small and tight, those of a young woman hardly out of girlhood. Teg wondered what these three therianthropic people made of the three humans. Did they see them as alike, since each had a human-style head, or did they notice the differences? "Teenagers?" Teg said aloud, suddenly uncomfortable with the silent staring. Meg laughed, a high, shrill sound more indicative of nerves than of humor. "That's your first impression, eh? I wasn't nearly as taken with their age as in that each of them are holding weapons." Peg snorted. "Well, I guess if you ignore the obvious, then that's what I noticed first, too, but I think Teg's right. They're just kids." Teg grinned weakly. "Kids with swords and spears." They'd been talking as if the three young people facing them couldn't understand what they said, maybe from shock, maybe because those animal heads made the trio seem less human, more animal, no matter the shape of their bodies.
"We're not kids,"
said the lion, thumping the butt end of his spear, or was that a staff, on the ground. His voice went from impressively deep and rumbly to almost a question on the final word. His ears flicked, then steadied, for all the world like those of a cat trying to pretend it hasn't just been caught doing something foolish.
"I suppose kid isn't the greatest choice of word," Peg admitted. "There's nothing goat-like about any of you."
"But you didn't say goat," said the deer, his voice a smooth baritone. He held a long sword with the easy confidence of one who knew how to use it. "You said child or youth. Didn't you?"
The fox yipped in what was clearly amusement and sheathed her twin swords. "Are we really going to worry about what words she used? These can't be the ones we were hoping for. I've never seen anything like them. What are they, anyhow, some sort of shaven-faced feline? No, that can't be it. The nose is all wrong for a feline, even if the eyes do face forward. They have teeth like equines, not a beak, or I might say they're some sort of owl."
"Whatever they are," the deer said, following the fox's example and sheathing his sword. "You're right, Varys. They're not those we hope to summon."
That's when, with horrible suddenness, the situation became real to the three women. Later, they'd agree that at first they'd been too startled to think, or, as Meg put it in her blunt way, they hadn't wanted to think. But at that moment, with the three young adults talking so calmly about summoning and clearly not recognizing them as human, the reality struck like a physical blow. As Peg said later, "If we hadn't been sitting, I would have been groping for a chair right about then." And it became clear that the three youths had also realized the enormous weirdness of the situation. For a very long moment, no one said anything. Then the fox woman and Peg spoke at once.
"What are
summoned?"
Peg's question, spoken with all the authority of her many years working with kids, her own and others, won out.
"Summoned? What do you mean?"
The lion tilted his head slightly to one side.
"Is this related to the matter of goats? A word you seem to not comprehend? Summoned. Called."
He considered.
"In this context, used to mean calling by means of magic. Does that help?"
Peg ignored his supercilious tone. She hadn't raised numerous teenagers without recognizing the insecurity that lurked behind the need to show off. Instead, she glanced over at Meg and Teg.
"Well, being magically summoned makes as much sense as anything. The only other option would be that one of you two decided to drop some acid in my tea, and that makes even less sense. The days when my friends thought putting acid in their friends' drinks without telling them was acceptable are long ago and far away."
"So we're in Narnia or something?"
Meg retorted tartly. Not Narnia, Teg corrected, obscurely comforted by the familiar arguing. If she closed her eyes, she might even imagine herself back at the table in Pagerian Books, debating the fine points of some novel. That had talking animals and mythological creatures, like dryads and water spirits. I don't think there were any people with animal heads. A few, Meg shot back, but those were monsters like the Minotaurs in the White Witch's army. Whatever else these may be, they're not monsters. The lion, fox, and deer had been staring at the three women in undisguised amazement. When there was a pause, the fox, Varys, cut in.
"Xerax answered your question," she said. "Now, would you tell us what you are?"
"We're humans," Meg replied. "And before you ask what a human is, I'll add that in matters of psychology and even spirituality, that is a question we're still asking ourselves."
"Meg, stop teasing her," Teg interrupted. "I'm sorry, this is a bit of a shock for us. You at least had the idea you were going to summon someone, although apparently not us, but we had no warning at all."
"Oh," the stag said, looking embarrassed, an expression that had something to do with his posture, something to do with the tilt of his large ears.
"I don't think we'd considered that. Still, would you mind explaining what a human is, physically, at least, if the other is a matter of debate? We've never seen creatures like you, not even in art. Are your faces supposed to be so hairless?"
He'd clearly substituted hairless for some other less polite descriptive term, and Teg took it upon herself to answer politeness with politeness. Maybe because, unlike Meg and Peg, she'd never had children, she didn't immediately think of these three as kids. Rather, they reminded her of the students at the field school, people with one foot in adulthood, the other still in childhood, switching back and forth with astonishing dexterity. "Yes, our faces are supposed to be hairless. Some of our males, we three are all female, can grow some facial hair, but that's usually reserved for the lower face. Before you ask, yes, our ears," she brushed her fingertips to indicate her ears, "are supposed to be at the sides of our heads rather than toward the top as with yours. We're also rather, mature specimens of our type. Meg is the eldest and I'm the youngest, but I'd wager even I am at least 3 decades your senior, if not more." Xerac, the lion, groaned, then quickly apologized.
"I'm sorry, ma'am, I was just thinking."
He looked at his 2 comrades.
"The spell got something right. We were looking for elders, those who could teach us what we need to know if..."
Varys, who seemed to be the most impulsive of the three, interrupted him.
"But these can't be who we need. They sound as if they know less than we do."
A tall shadow momentarily blocked the light as someone else entered the... chamber? Cave? What to call this place?
"I warned them," quavered a decidedly elderly voice. "I warned them that they needed to take more time, but would they listen to an ancient? Oh, no. They knew far more than I, who have dedicated my life to this place and its magics, could possibly know."
The speaker had the head of an owl, the sort with tufts of feathers that gave the impression of being ears. He wore a long turquoise-blue tunic, styled rather like the robes worn by Chinese mandarins, slit at the side and showing trousers beneath. He leaned on a tall staff topped with a crystal orb.
"Oh, please," Teg pleaded with what she hoped was her own imagination gone wild. "The wise old wizard is an owl? Is that incredibly cliched or what?"
From the looks on her 2 friends' faces, she could tell they were having similar thoughts. Peg was pinching the back of her hand the way she always did when she tried to suppress a desire to say something inflammatory, something all too easy to do when certain of the more dogmatic members of the book group tried to dominate a meeting. Meg had pushed her lips tightly together, deepening the network of lines around them. The 3 young people stiffened when they heard the self-proclaimed ancient speak.
"It wasn't that we knew more,"
said the deer, shifting restlessly. It's that we don't have the time to learn everything you know. If we were going to do that, we'd be as old as you by the time we finished. Stands to reason, right?
There was a note of triumph in his voice as he reached this conclusion.
Not precisely, young, man, Meg cut in. Much would depend on how this gentle man acquired his knowledge. If he learned it through traditional pedagogy, then you would be correct. However, if he acquired it in other ways, research or experimentation, then he might be able to relay to you in a few hours the results of years of hard labor. For the first time, the owl turned to examine the three women. He did not bend or peer, as a human of his age would have done. Teg wondered if he had an owl's proverbially sharp sight, for he seemed to take in every detail of them.
"Wise words," he said, blinking round dark amber eyes with deliberation. "And true as well. Much of what I have discovered took me decades to learn, but had these three been inclined to listen, I could have related it to them in a matter of several weeks, maybe a few months."
"But we may not have months," Zirak retorted, a hint of a roar underlying the words. "We have things we need to do."
"Calm down, young man." Peg rose and smoothed her hair, exuding authority. She looked sternly at the three summoners. "If, as this young woman, Varys, I believe you said, indicated, we are not the—"
She paused. Teg knew she'd been about to say droids and had caught herself just in time.
"People you meant to summon, then perhaps the first step in getting what you want would be to send us home again. Then you can consult with this gentleman," she inclined her head toward the owl, "and learn what you should do to correct your error."
"Can we?"
asked Zirek, addressing the owl.
"You can send them back, yes," the owl began.
Then, when the shoulders of the three young people began to relax in evident relief, he continued.
"However, you cannot summon anyone else. Hetua Shrine works only once for each person, unless—"
He shook his head so hard that the long ear feathers wobbled.
"Let's just leave it at, this shrine only works once. The contingencies would not apply at this time or in this situation. Even if they would," he sniffed, "no one would care to listen to the explanation."
Teg certainly wasn't interested, but his words had crystallized a faint sense of dread that she hadn't been aware of until this moment.
"We can go back? We're not trapped here?"
She would have asked more, but Meg was looking at the three young people with the same look she got when someone at the book club started talking about a friend who had been in some sort of trouble, and after a few sentences you realized that the friend under discussion was the speaker. Meg cut Teg off with a short, apologetic nod.
"Then if we go back, that's it, isn't it? That's the end for whatever it is that brought you here. Maybe you should at least explain to us what you were hoping for. It is possible, just possible, that we may be able to help you."
"But let's not talk here," Peg cut in. "At least, not until you bring chairs and sit with us. This is all too Stonehenge. I keep expecting druids holding sickles or maybe carrying one of those horrible wicker baskets to come stalking in."
The four-headed animal people looked completely mystified, but Meg and Teg understood immediately. There had been a gruesome sacrificial scene in a novel they'd read the previous Halloween, so the stone circle did evoke certain memories.
"Can we leave this stone circle?" Teg addressed the owl, "without ruining our chance to get home?"
Privately, she wondered why she was pressing the point so hard. It wasn't as if she had a lot to go home to. She was currently on sabbatical while she wrote up the results of her last dig. There were the cats, but it wasn't as if she had anyone in particular to miss her.
The owl replied, "No, leaving the circle will not violate your ability to return, although—"
When Peg attempted to cut him off, Meg raised a hand. "Please, Peg, I'd like to hear what comes after although,"
After what happened when these three were disinclined to listen to this gentleman, I don't think we should make the same mistake. Peg nodded and resumed her seat. Without even thinking, she reached behind herself for her omnipresent bag of knitting, picked out a project by touch, and began clicking yarn into something pale blue and fluffy, probably, if past experience was anything to judge by, a baby blanket. Even when one of her 8 children, 4 of her body, 4 step, wasn't providing an excuse, Peg donated blankets to a program at the local hospital that, in turn, gave them to indigent young mothers. Peg's reaching for her knitting made Tag wonder if her purse and messenger bag had come through with her. Had she hung them on the chair as Peg had her knitting, or tucked them on the floor next to her? Before she could check, the owl's words as he completed his interrupted sentence wiped everything else from her mind.
Whether you leave the circle will not violate your ability to return, although that provision will only hold for the next several hours. After that, the chance will diminish until it vanishes entirely.
He stopped, saw from the expressions on the 3 women's faces that he had made an impression, and then continued more kindly.
However, if for some reason you do decide it is your task to assist these impulsive ones, it may be possible to arrange the means by which you can move between this place and your homes, somewhat at will.
Is it complicated?
Meg asked at the same time Peg said, Is it dangerous?
It is more complicated than it is dangerous, the owl said. But certainly there is danger involved. There always is when performing a complex magical working.
His glower was clearly meant for the fox, the stag, and the lion, all of whom looked appropriately chastened.
Very well, Meg said, taking the lead, as she so often did in book group discussions. Then, before we attempt this possibly dangerous and definitely complicated procedure, perhaps we should investigate whether we intend to have commerce with this land. If we do not, then the point is moot.
Well put, good lady, the owl said.
He looked as if he was about to swoon from admiration. Meg had that effect on a lot of people, Tag had noticed. It seemed that Meg's impressive aura extended to owls and possibly, looking at the 3 summoners, to lions, foxes, and stags as well.
If we are going to have a lengthy discussion, Peg said, may we please move from this place? I wasn't joking when I said it gave me the heebie-jeebies.
I have an office, the owl said, a trace dubiously. But it is crowded already and would not suit such a large group. Perhaps the terrace would be better. Yes, much better. That way our visitors can see something of this new land to which they have been brought.
But the time, Tag pressed. I know how all of us can get caught up in an interesting discussion. What if we overstay our time?
You have until sunset, the owl said, before the option to return diminishes. Even after that, you will have until noon the next day before the option is completely gone. I would caution you to make your decision before dawn.
Because the hours between dawn and noon will be when the chance is lowest, Tag guessed.
And because I am really much less alert when the sun is high, the owl said. A fact that was brought home to me quite firmly today.
Again he glowered at the 3 young people.
You take our guests out to the terrace. I will gather some refreshments and join you presently.
He bowed to them and turned away. Trying to study him with the same objectivity she brought to archaeology, Teg noted that he didn't seem to have wings, and that the transition between owl head and more human body seemed to happen somewhere around neck level, since rather than hair, his head feathers just brushed his collar.
This way, said Zirek, his voice husky. The terrace is this way.
Do you want us to carry your chairs? Asked Veriz. I believe there are seats already there, but maybe these are special to you?
No, we just happened to be sitting in them when your call came, Peg replied.
If there's nothing out on the terrace to suit us, we'll just send the boys back.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?